So as I mentioned before, our passage this morning, as we continue in 1 John, is 1 John chapter 5, verses 1 to 5. And three times then, this passage refers to certain people who are born of God. That phrase appears twice in verse 1, and it occurs again in verse 4. So what does it mean? What is this birth of which John speaks? Well, this birth is a supernatural event whereby a human being becomes one of God's children, a member of his family. Apart from this supernatural event taking place, no human being is that. Indeed, if it hasn't taken place in your life, then you are not a member of God's family. You relate to God only as a creature to its creator, not as a child to its father. But when this special birth occurs, I'm saying, then that changes. Your relationship to God is then placed on an altogether different footing. There's intimacy now, and there's closeness now. You're his son, you're his daughter. Now, having described this birth in those terms, there's something else that I must quickly add. I've used the word supernatural there. But please don't confuse supernatural with outwardly spectacular. The two things don't necessarily go together. I mean, you can't get much more radically supernatural, can you, than the virgin conception of Jesus Christ? And yet, the moment that that event took place, every single person on the planet, including actually the very woman in whose body it was happening, was utterly oblivious. The fundamental laws of biology were being fantastically rewritten, and yet no one had a clue that anything was going on. So something, I'm saying, can be profoundly supernatural without being outwardly spectacular. And that's true of this supernatural event that we're talking about this morning. This moment when a human being becomes a child of God, it can occur in an inconspicuous manner. Indeed, this supernatural birth from God may well be a good deal less spectacular than a natural birth from a human mother generally is. I mean, a natural birth, even when nothing goes particularly wrong, it's a fairly dramatic business, isn't it? There are contractions, and there's a rush to hospital, and there are midwives involved, and the exact time of the birth is carefully recorded, and phone calls are swiftly made to family and friends. It's all quite intense and quite frenetic. And sometimes, when a person is born of God, that drama is there. It is involved. In the case of Saul, on the road to Damascus, it was pretty dramatic. But it's often not like that. For every Saul of Tarsus on the Damascus road, there are many more Lydias by the riverside in Philippi, just quietly and uncomplicatedly born of God. Indeed, I think there's good biblical evidence that this birth from God can precede natural birth. It can happen while a person is still in the womb. I rather suspect, actually, that it often does. And in those cases, then, it's even less outwardly spectacular than in Lydia's case. And I'm labouring this point at the outset this morning because whenever a preacher starts talking about this special birth from God, it can result in people who are in fact God's children, who are in fact members of his family, becoming unsettled. Hang on a minute, they begin to think. If membership of God's family involves this highly supernatural birth, well, I'm not sure then that I'm the genuine article after all. I was never conscious of some decisive divine intervention in my life whereby I went to bed one night a completely different person from when I gotten up that morning. Perhaps, therefore, I'm just kidding myself. Perhaps my Christian life is all one big pretense. I don't want any genuine child of God here this morning to be thus unsettled. Indeed, nothing would be more ironic than a sermon from 1 John serving to undermine a Christian's assurance. One of John's great concerns in writing this letter is to strengthen his reader's assurance. So those of you who are living as children of God, but who have no exciting story to tell about a Damascus Road kind of birth experience, please don't be unsettled this morning. Understand that the absence of dramatic circumstances does not indicate the absence of a supernatural birth from God. But we must hasten on and get into this paragraph here and take note then of three things that this birth leads to. Three things that this birth that we're looking at this morning leads to. And first of all, faith. Faith. This birth that we're talking about this morning leads to faith. And a couple of things are worth teasing out from that. Where faith comes and what faith is. So first of all, where faith comes. Did you get that sentence that I uttered just now? This birth that we're talking about this morning leads to faith. So let's think about how you and I came to experience salvation. The sequence, the order that was involved. Where did our faith come in that sequence and in that order? Well, if that sentence I uttered just now is true, it didn't come first. Our faith did not come first. That is to say, if you're a saved person, your faith was not the entry point that opened the floodgates and brought the blessings of salvation cascading into your life. Something else was the entry point. And that something else was this birth. It came first. Your faith is a product of you first having been born of God. Your faith is actually one of the blessings which that birth brought cascading into your life. You can't miss that in the tenses that John uses there in the first half of verse 1. He says, everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ has been born of God. John Stott comments, it shows clearly that believing is the consequence, not the cause, of the new birth. In other words, you have not been born into God's family because you believed. Rather, you believe because you have been born into God's family. That may surprise some of you. You may have thought that your faith did come first in the chain of events. That you believed, and thus on the basis of that faith, were born of God. And perhaps indeed, now that I'm showing you these tenses that John uses and the force of those tenses is sinking in, you're starting to think, well, if it wasn't my believing then that secured my birth into God's family, what did I do to secure that birth into God's family? And the answer is nothing. Absolutely nothing at all. I mean, what did you do to get yourself born into your natural family? Nothing. When you were born a Johnson or a Smith or a Curnow or a Peters or whatever, what had you done to make that happen? Nothing. You didn't ask for it. You didn't seek it. You didn't choose it. You weren't consulted on the matter at all. It was something that simply happened to you entirely outside of your control. And it's exactly the same with your birth into God's family. It was simply something that happened to you entirely outside of your control. Your faith didn't bring it about, and nor did any other contribution on your part, which is why you really can sing this morning, "Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me." You see, if when all is said and done, your Christian experience, your enjoyment of all the blessings of salvation, if when all is said and done, it's to be traced back to you deciding to believe in Jesus, and that's the bottom line, and that's the root from which it all stems, then we need to change John Newton's lyrics. It's not "Amazing Grace" anymore. It's "Amazing Me." Amazing me, managing to do what so many don't manage to do, and having the initiative and the wherewithal to put my faith in Jesus Christ. But if your Christian experience isn't to be traced back to you deciding to believe in Jesus, if in fact it stems from a decision that God made without any input whatsoever from you, if you're a child of God this morning because without your consent and without your agreement and without your involvement in any shape or form, God caused you to be born into his family, then Newton's lyrics are bang on. It's amazing grace, all right. Awesome, mysterious, humbling, pride-shattering, amazing grace. So where faith comes, it doesn't come first. But then also what faith is. What faith is. Think for a moment of a newborn baby being held aloft by the midwife who has just delivered it. And that baby is warm. And that baby is crying. And that baby is moving its limbs. And all those things are signs of life, aren't they? No one in the room is asking, is that baby really alive? Or is that just a plastic doll that the midwife is holding up there? Not when there's warmth and there's crying and there are moving limbs. There's an unmistakable vigor and vitality in those phenomena. And I think we can infer from the first half of verse 1 here that the equivalent when it comes to this birth from God is faith. Faith is like the newborn baby's cry. It's the immediate, instinctive response of a newborn child of God. The newborn child of God, as it were, comes out of the womb showing it's alive by its faith. Because faith, you see, is this vigorous, spirited thing, redolent with life. And that's such an important point. By itself, the phrase John uses for faith there in verse 1 could give the wrong impression. He says, everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ. That's what John says. And that could sound then like faith is just a dull, dry, intellectual assent to a particular proposition about Jesus. But John's description of faith shouldn't be read by itself. It should be read in its context there. Everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ has been born of God. He can't have in mind a dull, dry, intellectual assent, because that kind of faith wouldn't be a sign of life. It wouldn't scream out, a birth has taken place here and this person is alive. And the faith that does scream that out then must be far more than intellectual assent. To be sure, it includes intellectual assent. All genuine Christian faith does assent to certain propositions and facts and truths. But if faith is the newborn baby's cry, if faith is the child of God kicking and wriggling and demonstrating it's a living thing, then it must be more than intellectual assent. Faith must be something dynamic and energetic, something that doesn't merely accept facts about Jesus, but wants Jesus and grasps Jesus and stakes everything on Jesus and sings to Jesus, I need thee, oh, I need thee every hour, I need thee. That's the kind of thing that faith must be. Many times I've stressed from this lectern that faith is not a work. It's utterly, 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 utterly different from a work, because faith doesn't offer anything. There's nothing virtuous and admirable and beautiful about faith like there is about love, for instance. Love is a work. Faith is not a work. Faith doesn't offer anything. Faith just receives. Faith just takes. Faith just avails itself of Christ and his salvation. Faith just leans on the finished work of Jesus. And that is absolutely true. And nothing I'm saying this morning remotely contradicts that. Faith is just leaning on the finished work of Jesus. But this is the point I'm making today. Leaning on the finished work of Jesus isn't something you can do in a listless and lethargic way. Just throwing out a sinner's prayer at some point in your life and rarely thinking any more about it. That's not faith. Faith is leaning on the finished work of Jesus urgently and irrepressibly. Because faith is what newly alive people exercise. Faith is an intensely animate business that springs from a birth having taken place. Is that your faith then? To touch again on the matter I raised in my introduction, I'm far more interested in this than in whether you have a great story to tell about how you were born again on this date or on that date. That's relatively inconsequential. I'm interested in whether or not today there is this sign of life, this pulse manifesting that you're a child of God, namely a living faith in Jesus Christ, a deep-seated sense of I need thee. Oh, I need thee every hour. I need thee. So this birth then, faith, is the first thing that it leads to, and I wanted to spend longest on that this morning. But then secondly, love. Love. This birth, it leads to faith. It leads also to love. So being born into a natural family ought to result in two loves being present. There should be a love for the parents of which you have been born, and there should be a love for the siblings along with whom you have been born of those parents. That's how it should work, isn't it? It doesn't always work like that, of course, but all things being equal, being born into a natural family should result in those two loves. Love for parents, love for siblings. And it's the same then with this birth that we're talking about this morning. It should result in two loves, and they're both mentioned there in the second half of verse 1. Everyone who loves the Father loves whoever has been born of him. So there's love for the Father, God, and there's love for siblings, whoever has been born of him. That's other Christians. These two loves you can see there in the second half of the verse. Now, it's been a few weeks since we were last in this book, but you may dimly remember that the pairing of these two loves has been a massive theme throughout it, and not least actually in the preceding chapter, in chapter 4. It has been this massive theme. So that you might be thinking here, oh, for goodness sake, John, don't get back onto this again. Yes, you're a stuck record, man. We know that the born-again person loves God and loves his or her brother and sister. Don't tell us that again. Tell us something new, won't you, John? Well, actually, even as he revisits this now familiar theme, John does tell us something new. Don't gloss over verse 2, because the emphasis you find in verse 2 is, in fact, the exact opposite of the emphasis that has dominated the letter so far. So up until this point, John's concern has been this. It's possible for there to be in a person's life the appearance of loving God, because there's lots of prayer going on and there's lots of religious activity going on. But it is, in fact, just an appearance. That person just thrives on ritual and all the box-ticking aspects of religious activity, dotting I's and crossing T's. He or she doesn't really love God. And the telltale sign, John has kept saying, the telltale sign that it isn't the real thing is how that person relates to others. There's little kindness in that person, a little warmth in that person, a little helpfulness in that person towards others in the church. And that's the kind of situation then that John has been interested in this letter. His emphasis has been this: we know that we love God when we love the children of God. Love for others backs up and makes credible our love for God. That's been John's emphasis. But now look at verse 2 here. By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God. Do you see how that's precisely the other way around? John is not saying here that love for the children of God backs up our love for God. He's putting it the other way around. He's saying love for God backs up and makes credible our love for others. Now, in this connection, notice the close relationship that John indicates there is between loving God and obeying his commands. The first half of verse 3, this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. And at this point, I'm just going to mention a couple of God's commandments. Now, they might seem rather random ones, but there's a logic to this that will become clear. So here's one commandment. Be content with what you have. Be content with what you have. God commands that in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5. And here's the other commandment. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. God commands that in Matthew 6, verse 19. Now, imagine this scenario. There's a person in a church, and he or she is just a really nice person who remembers people's names and takes an interest in their circumstances and their problems and dilemmas. So that people want to talk to that person over coffee after the service. And that person is missed when not at church. And everyone would say about that person, he or she really loves the church family. But that same person, Monday to Saturday, isn't living a contented existence, but is in fact craving all sorts of things, craving a lifestyle, craving a level of wealth and success, craving a woman, craving whatever it might be. Or perhaps that person has everything that he or she craves and so isn't discontented, but is treasuring those things that they possess excessively, deriving a sense of worth and a sense of security from possessing them. Well, in that case, the person isn't loving the God who commands be content with what you have, or the God who commands do not lay up treasures for yourselves on earth. And thus that person's apparent love for others on a Sunday in the church isn't genuine because it isn't being backed up and made credible by a love for God. And that then is John's emphasis in this morning's passage. He's emphasized aplenty that love for God must be backed up by love for others. Now he's emphasizing that love for others must be backed up by a commandment-keeping love for God. And I just want to ask the question then, are both of these loves flourishing in your Christian life this morning? Being born of God leads to faith, but it also leads to love. And that love is two-dimensional. It's love for God, and it's love for brothers and sisters in Christ. And the two cannot be separated. They can be distinguished, but they cannot be separated. Perhaps you've watched the heptathlon at the Olympic Games this past week. Katarina Johnson-Thompson winning a silver medal for Great Britain in that event. And a heptathlete then cannot pick and choose events. Well, I'm only going to do four of them. I'm going to ignore all the others. No, the seven events all belong together, and they must all be participated in. And it's the same with loving God and loving brothers and sisters when you're a Christian. You can't pick and choose. They both belong together. So that either of those loves is only credible if it's accompanied by the other. One cannot stand alone. Without the other, either of them is discredited altogether. It's a challenge, isn't it? Are both these loves flourishing in my life, in your life, this morning? So being born of God, then, it leads to faith, and being born of God leads to love. But then, thirdly and finally, victory. Being born of God leads to victory. So in the second half of verse 3, John says, he said in the first half, we've already seen, this is the love of God that we keep his commandments. And then in the second half, he says, and his commandments are not burdensome. He means by that, they're not unmanageable. They're not excessive. They're not too much for us as Christians. I notice that he then begins the next verse with that little word for. So he's now going to explain what he has just claimed. He's just claimed that God's commandments are not unmanageable, and he's now going to explain why that's the case. And his explanation is then, for everyone who has been born of God overcomes the world. Now, we need to recall at this point how John has defined the world. And that's why we read those verses earlier on in our service from chapter 2. Because for John then, the world is not the creation. And all the wonderful possibilities and pursuits that the creation makes possible, like music and sport and art and cuisine and so on. That's not what the world is. So that for John, worldliness or being worldly is not enjoying all those things. No, those things are good. And those things are to be enjoyed. And they are to be enjoyed with thankfulness to God who has freely given those things to us. So this has been often misunderstood in the history of the church and is still often misunderstood, I'm sure, in many quarters today. That the world is just all those pleasures that I've just mentioned and so we should be a bit suspicious of those. No, those things I've just mentioned are good gifts from God that he has given us to enjoy. And so when John talks about worldliness, he's not talking about enjoying music and art and sport and travel and so on. Because he's quite clear in those verses in chapter 2, rather the world, in his definition, is a mindset. The world is a way of thinking. And he sums it up then in chapter 2, verse 16, as the desires of the flesh. And that may not mean too much to you, but he then breaks that down into two further categories, namely the desires of the eyes and pride in possessions. Some ESVs, I think, still have pride of life. Pride in possessions is much preferable. So this then is the mindset, the way of thinking that for John is what the world is and worldliness is. It's the desires of the eyes and pride in possessions. And I think when I preached on this several months ago now, I defined that in these terms. Worldliness is desperately craving what you do not have. That's the desires of the eyes. And it's treasuring smugly all that you do have. That's pride in possessions. So that's what John is condemning here. Not enjoying the creation and all the wonderful things that God has put in this creation for us. What John is concerned about there is desperately craving what you don't have and treasuring smugly all that you do have. Being worldly is behaving like that. Now, remember those two commandments that I singled out a moment ago. Be content with what you have, Hebrews 13:5. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, Matthew 6:19. And what do those two commandments do then? Well, they fly directly in the face of the world, as John defines it in his letter. They are absolutely antithetical to the world. Being worldly is craving desperately what you don't have. God's commandment is be content with what you have. Being worldly is treasuring smugly all that you do have. God's commandment is do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. Which means then, that in every Christian's life, there's this battle, there's this tug of war that's going on. On the one hand, we are being pulled by the world, by the intoxicating draw of craving desperately things and treasuring smugly things. But on the other hand, we're being pulled in the opposite direction by God's commandments. Be content. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. And you might think, well, that's a pretty one-sided tug of war, is it not? Isn't the world just going to win? Given the mighty pull of craving and treasuring, especially in a society like ours where we're bombarded with that all the time, aren't God's commandments just going to prove burdensome, unmanageable, undoable, unattainable, unachievable? But John's answer is no. He says, everyone who has been born of God overcomes the world. Overcomes the world. And hence this third point then that I'm making this morning, this birth from God as well as leading to faith and to love, it leads to victory. It leads to victory over this pull that seems so strong of that worldly mindset. Perhaps this morning you're feeling very keenly as a Christian the conflict between these two pulls. Perhaps things are going very well for you. You're rising up the ladder in your career. You're earning more money than you've ever earned before. There's nothing wrong with any of those things. But such times can be dangerous for the Christian. And you can easily then get carried away and begin to value all those things inordinately and unhealthily. Treasures on earth, which perhaps in the past didn't really seem all that big in your thinking, they suddenly become very real perhaps, and very enthralling. And perhaps you're aware then of that pull on you this morning. And perhaps you're somewhat frightened as you feel that pull, because you feel helpless in the face of it. You feel you can't resist that pull. You can't do anything about it. John is saying you absolutely can do something about it. You can overcome the world. You're born of God. This birth from God leads to victory. You can overcome that pull. Strong though it is, mighty though it is, you can overcome that pull that's craving and treasuring are exercising upon you this morning. But perhaps you say, yeah, but it might not be as simple as that, Dan. You remember how a few weeks ago we had Andy Murray's retirement from tennis or from Wimbledon, I'm particularly thinking. And you remember how then he had to pull out of the singles, but he played in the doubles with his brother and played then that last match at Wimbledon along with his brother. And it's quite interesting how his brother then has been a reasonably successful doubles player, but Andy Murray, of course, has been known for his success as a singles player. And some say, and this may be very unfair on Andy Murray, I don't know, but Jamie Murray, his brother, some say that it's because Jamie lacks his brother's mental toughness. And so Andy Murray has been able to thrive in the singles context, which is so hard because he has this superior mental toughness to his brother. And so if that's true then, and we'll assume it is for the sake of argument, you have these two brothers born of the same parents, but one then receives through that birth this attribute that the other doesn't. One gets this mental toughness that enables him to thrive in the arena of the singles, and the other doesn't get that mental toughness. And you might be thinking then, well, perhaps there's some attribute that enables the Christian to be victorious over the world, but only some of the born again get it. In that birth from God, it's passed on only to some, but not to others. There are the Andy Murrays, but there's also the Jamie Murrays. But again, John says, no. Look at the second half of verse 4. And this is the victory that has overcome the world. Our faith. In other words, this thing that enables our victory over the world, it's this thing that we said before, every newborn child of God immediately and categorically and unambiguously has faith. That's the attribute that's necessary. And this is so important because I think we can sometimes think, well, you know, if I'm going to overcome the world, and it's pull on me, and I'm going to resist those covetous desires and that swaggering self-reliance that's so rampant in our society. If I'm going to get the better of all of that, then I need more resources. I need more resources. I need some special experience of the Holy Spirit, perhaps. I need some technique that some Christian guru somewhere in the world can show me on YouTube. And John is saying, no. Just that simple faith that sprang into life the day you were born again. That's all you need. That unites you to Jesus Christ and makes available to you all the resources you could ever possibly need. And so if you're a child of God, therefore you do have faith, and therefore you can go out tomorrow in a world that is trying to get you to idolize stuff. And you can overcome the world. And you can beat it. And you can keep on living for the glory of God. And living a holy life. And a God-honoring life. You can. You don't need something else. You've all the resources you need. This is the victory that overcomes the world. Just our faith. That simple, puny faith, as small as a mustard seed. That's all you need. It unites you to Christ. It makes you a victor. Don't say, well, I can't fight because I haven't been sufficiently resourced. Go and fight. Go and fight the world tomorrow. Fight the desires of the eyes and pride in possessions. Be content with what you have. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. You can obey those commandments because as a child of God, you are a victor. May God bless his word. Amen.